Ecclesiastes is one of those books that doesn't make for a real cheerful reading, especially compared to the book of Proverbs. And you look at the book of Proverbs and it says, if you wake up early, do your work, go out, sow your seed, you can expect increase. And then Ecclesiastes is kind of the other side. It says, I got up early, I sowed the seed, but a hurricane came and blew it all away. And so, but that's the way life is sometimes. We all have things that we do, jobs and things like that we look at and we think, how could somebody do that job? I could never do that job. The one job, every time I pull into a grocery store, the job I see that I would not do, could not do, is the grocery cart wrangler. It's like you see those guys out there, you know, whether it's raining like it is today, or it's bitterly cold, or it's blazing hot, and they're going out and they're gathering up the carts to bring them in, expressly so people like you and me could get them and take them back out to the parking lot. In and out, over and over again, this kind of like fruitless cycle of gathering it up and it goes back out. And if it was my job, I would probably get fired because I'd be standing there, people would be coming, they'd go to get a cart and say, what are you here after? I'm going to get a gallon of milk. You don't need a cart. You can carry it. Yeah, and I could be catching them at the door. It's three bags. Three bags, little old lady. You can carry those. And so it's like every time I see that, I think, man, I would not want to have that job. Because I'm the type of person that repetition bugs me. It's like I used to work over in the East End, and I had about four different ways I could get home. Because I just could not stand driving the same way every day. And so even from here, there's only two ways you can go that's not too far out of the way. So most of the time I just go straight down 44, but sometimes I'll be there at the light right there and I'll think, I don't want to go this way today. So I'll turn left and I'll go out and hit 480 and go out that way, even though it's a further trip. And it's like that repetition. That repetition is what kind of gets to me. And it's like the quote by Yogi Berra. He said, it's deja vu all over again. It's like the same thing that was done before, we're just doing it all over again. And life has a repetitiveness to it. Under certain conditions, that can just be kind of numbing. And so many of you may have had jobs and tasks and things you've had to do that's just been, it's the same thing over and over again. You never feel like you're getting anywhere. You never feel like you're getting done. It's just the same stuff, but a different day. And life is just full of stuff like that. It's like, and I know ladies with the housework, that's what you feel like many times. You're washing dishes. And I remember my mom used to get so angry. She would not even be finished washing the dishes, and we would come and get another glass for some milk. And she's like, I'm not even done washing the ones we have for supper yet. And I do feel the same way now. It's like, no matter how often you wash them, there they are again. And especially like today, you know, when you saw the gas prices, putting gas in the car. You know, it's something it's just a mind-numbing cycle. You got to put it in and put it in and put it in, and it never stays full. And you take, you know, something like brushing your teeth. You know, it's something you have to do, but it's something every day you got to do it, and you wonder, is this making any bit of difference? Well, it is. Thank you for brushing your teeth. I saw a program about the Golden Gate Bridge out in San Francisco, that there's a crew there that it's their permanent, full-time, year-round job to paint that bridge. They start at one end, they work all the way through, and by the time they get to the other end, it's time to go back to the beginning and start all over again. So their entire life is spent painting a bridge. That's probably one of the jobs that I really, really wouldn't want to do. And I really had a hard adjustment. When I was young, I worked for my dad, and he has a construction company, and we did like sidewalks, concrete sidewalks, basement floors, and there were... I felt a sense of accomplishment that when I was done with that, I was done with that job. I didn't have to go back to it. And then later on, I could be driving by and saying, hey, I was here when that sidewalk was poured. When I started an office job in engineering, it really was difficult to get a sense of accomplishment, a sense of, because I'd be working on one job, it would be over, and I would start working on the next job, but it was just sheets of paper that I was working on again. It was like the same stuff over and over again, this repetitiveness. And so sometimes it can appear that we get caught in this endless cycle of nothing. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, in chapter 1, the preacher looks at, under the sun, this never-ending grind of life. So let's read that. Let's look at verses 3 through 11. We're going to overlap just a little bit with what we went over last week. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And you'll remember we defined under the sun as life without looking at life without taking into account God. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what it will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been. It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. So, I mean, you could hear the weariness in his voice of just observing things, this relentless, cyclical life that he is in. And under the sun, apart from God, all toil eventually is meaningless and futile. And he first starts off there in verses 3 through 7. He talks about the great cycles of nature. And many times when we're looking to point to evidence for God's handiwork, we by nature point to creation because it is so wonderful. And if you want to, we're going to turn over and look at a section of Psalm 104 where the psalmist does just that. He points to basically much of the same material that the preacher in Ecclesiastes looks at and finds meaninglessness. The psalmist, because he is viewing life with God, in attachment to God, he sees nature in a completely different way. Psalm 104, 19 through 24. Just listen for the comparison. Speaking about God here, so he made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness and in this night, when all the beasts of the forest creep about, the young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away and lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to his labor until the evening. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom have you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. And he goes on, he talks about the sea and all that sort of thing there. But because he is taking into account that this is something established by God, he sees purpose. He says, well, it's night because that's when the night creatures feed. It's daytime because that's when we get to have light to work. He sees God's handiwork in all this. The preacher, though, in showing us life without God, sees things in a whole different way. He sees that you remove God and nature just becomes this meaningless cycle that goes on and on, this grind that goes on and on and on. One generation comes, goes, and another comes. Is there any real change? He says, you know, people are born, people die off. Each group is replaced by another group, but is there any point to it all? Does anything ever change? When we think about it, he has many points in certain aspects because human nature is the same now as it was 4,000 years ago. People are still people, and the generation, the way that people are now, their nature, is the same as it was years ago. Genesis 6:5 said that God looked at the world, he said that the inclination of man's heart is continuously to evil. And if he looked at the world today, he would see the same thing. Because human nature has not changed. You come and go. Groups of people come and go. But humanity has stayed the same. Talking about the sun's endless race, going around and around again. And we look at that and we see the steadfast faithfulness of God. That the sun constantly rises, brings us light, brings us life. The earth, all of life on earth is dependent upon the sun being there. But you remove God from the picture and you see the sun running its race over and over again. And you think it's just one more day. And we've all probably been there at times when our eyes open up and we don't say, good morning, Lord. We say, good Lord, it's morning, because we know we're in a grind at that particular point. We're stuck in some rut in our life. We know that today is going to be just like it was yesterday. I'm going to get up. I'm going to work myself to the bone. I'm going to come home, fall in bed, and get up tomorrow, do the same thing all over again. And what's it really gaining me? When it says that the sun hastens back to its place again, like it goes, arches across the sky. And of course, this is talking about, the way the ancients saw the world. So the sun comes up in the east, goes across the sky, goes down in the west. So to their spot, to their mind of thinking, they didn't realize that it was going on the other side of the earth. To them, it's like it goes down over here and then it rushes back to where it starts and does the whole thing over again. And so it says it hastens back. Literally, it means that it gasps for breath. So the sun goes down and then it hurries back to its spot and it's trapped in that same cycle. It reminded me of the song Time by Pink Floyd. So you run and you run to catch up with the sun, but it's sinking, racing around to come up behind you again. The sun is the same in a relative way, but you're older, shorter of breath, and one day closer to death. And life under the sun, lived without any kind of transcend, anything penetrating beyond what we see and do, is that endless cycle. We chase after it. We chase after things. We get nowhere. He moves on to talk about the wind. We think about the wind. We think about it being the wind being, I want to be free like the wind. I want to run like the wind because the wind is free. It can go wherever it wants. He says, no, it comes, it goes to the north. It blows to the south. It goes on a circuit. It comes back. It gets nowhere. It just blows round and around. And it reminded me of when a friend of mine and I, when we were back in college, we drove out to California. And one of the nights that we camped out, it was in the canyon lands of Utah. And so we're there, and we're surrounded by all these canyons, and it was really a weird phenomenon because we'd be sitting there, and we'd hear a breeze blow through our campground. And then we'd go down the canyon. You could literally hear the breeze blowing around in the canyon. So, then you'd hear it coming. It'd blow right back through the campground again. It was going round and around, getting nowhere, just blowing around constantly in this cycle. So even the breeze can sometimes be in a rut. And later in the book of Ecclesiastes, futility is likened to a chasing after the wind, of trying to catch something that's has no substance, that just blows here and there, getting nowhere. And then he moves on and talks about the rivers. The same rivers run to the same sea over and over again, but yet the sea never gets full. And so you have this constant cycle. And he, you know, is not talking about, we would think, well, of course not, you know, that the ocean evaporates and the water comes, forms clouds, comes in, and it rains, and so we have to have this water cycle in order to keep having fresh water. But for him, he's saying, look, you know, you see a river, your grandpa, great-great-grandpa saw that same river flowing the same way. Nothing has changed. It's the same endless cycle over and over again, and they can seem endless and fruitless. The river just keeps on rolling to the sea. It reminded me of a Greek myth I heard about one time about this guy. His name was Sisyphus, and for whatever reason, he came under disfavor with the gods. And so the punishment that they crafted for him was they gave him this boulder, and he had to roll this boulder up this hill. And when he got to the top of the hill was so narrow, he could never get the boulder to balance on the top of the hill. It would roll back down the other side. And so for all eternity, he had to roll this boulder up the hill and then watch it roll down the other side and then go down there and roll it back up. This whole idea that they'd be punishing him by putting him into this fruitless, endless cycle. And it leads to a weariness of the soul. And you see that when he says, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. All things are full of weariness. Or this is what you get when you think inside the box. If we look at the world as a closed system, nothing transcendent, no God, thinking just inside the box, then that's what you get. You get a weariness of soul. You realize things are just wearing me out. We're going nowhere fast. And so the natural world is full of all this meaningless activity. The earth, wind, water, and fire are all locked in a meaningless cycle of repetitiveness, but never getting anywhere, never achieving anything of permanence. You look at it and you think, well, we have to have this because we're thinking about it from a long-term perspective. You know, we have to sow the grain so that the crops can grow so that we can have food to eat. But you go and you eat your food and you got to go do the same thing over and over again. And is there ever an end to it? There's never an end to this. And the unconscious activity of the natural world gains nothing of permanence. And that's what he's driving at. There's nothing permanent here. It's all temporary. And this meaninglessness of activity that you see in nature is mirrored in human life as well. He says, no one can utter it. No man can utter it. No one can speak meaningfully about the world. All the philosophers and wise men can philosophize about things, but their ideas ultimately have no meaning, and they pass away, and they themselves pass out of existence. And so nothing is permanent. The eye is never satisfied with all it sees. And how do we know that? Because every last one of us, for them probably, has got a little square box at home that's plugged into the wall, and they got a little device that we hold, and we spend hours upon hours going. Because our eyes never find what's going to satisfy them. We constantly switch from 250 channels, and we can't find one that has anything that our eyes want to see. Keep going over and over again. We're never. But what do we do? Every night we sit down and do that, expecting that that night we're going to find something that's going to satisfy our eyes, and we never do. Same thing is true. The ear takes in everything that bombards it. You can't shut it out. We can't tune things out. Just our ears never get tired, never get full. We constantly hear everything that's going on. I think about the 24-hour news cycle that we have now, where an event will happen, and then that event will be any no matter what channel, news channel you turn to, they're talking about the same event from the same perspective over and over again, and it solves nothing. All these guys get in there, give their opinion, and it matters not a bit. And then once the next thing happens, this thing is forgotten about. Think about, we heard tonight about folks who have remembered Haiti. But, you have one event that happens and the whole world rises up. But then as soon as the next thing happens, this first event passes away, the next thing comes because the eyes and the ears take in everything and are never satisfied. They have to keep constantly moving on to the next thing. And the ceaseless sights and sounds and opinions that we hear gain nothing of permanence. And then we come to verse 10. And so somebody offers up this and says to the preacher, says, is there a thing of which it is said? See, this is new. So this might be a place where we can interject and say, look, man, you're bringing me down. So I'm going to show you something new. I found something new here. I'm going to let you evaluate this. But he shoots that down pretty quick and says, it has already been in the ages before us. So nothing is really new. This is always the same old, tomorrow will be the same as yesterday, and there's nothing new in this world. Now that, saying there's nothing new in this world, that's a hard point to prove. It's a hard point to prove because, we live in an age of abounding technology when we can point to, our lives are so different from our great-grandparents. Our great-grandparents have more in common with the man who wrote Ecclesiastes than they do with us. Because so much has changed in that last 200 years as far as technology. I mean, so you think about the way we travel, the way we preserve and cook food, our medicine, all that stuff. Our great-grandparents have more in common with the man who wrote Ecclesiastes than they do with us. And that's a pretty incredible thing. So we might point and say, see, this is new. We have canned food, microwave ovens, refrigerators. We have cars, cell phones, MP3 players, and TVs. We have antibiotics, pacemakers, Tylenol, and Preparation H. So we have all this new stuff, man. So what do you have to say to that? And he says, well, no, not really. He says, we've always had ways to feed ourselves, but yet people still starve to death. We've always had ways to communicate, but we still misunderstand one another. We've always had ways to treat illness and disease, and yet we still die. There's nothing new. There's no stoppage to the human condition. We change the way we do things, and we have different technologies. We may be able to do things faster and better, but we have never come to an end of anything. We've never obliterated these things that we have to do. And so there's really nothing new under the sun. Humanity can never rise above itself. What I mean by that is that we're always, humanity is always going to be inherently limited because of our nature. There's nothing new that's going to come along that's going to put a stop to part of human nature. It may make benefits. I mean, I'm very happy for modern medical science, but yet, has it really changed the way that people are? It hasn't, because people still get sick. They have to be treated. They're treated in better ways, perhaps, but they still have to be treated for the illnesses that are just part of the human makeup. And yet, so we're always going to be hemmed in by the same boundaries. So when he says there's nothing new, he doesn't say that technology doesn't change. What he's saying is that the limitations that come from being human, they may shift around, but they're still there. We're always going to be hemmed in by these same limitations. And all of our furious activity makes no real headway and no gain. I remember there was a young man that I used to work with, and he and I were talking one time about the space program. And you know, he was real proponent of that and talking about all the technology that came out. I said it really hasn't done anything for humanity. And he just about literally fell over. He's like, you look at all the technology that's come from it. I said, but it has not in any way made people better. People are still the same people. We may have technology out of it, but it hasn't changed who we are as humans. As a matter of fact, you could say that every good thing you point to in technology, you could probably find another half a dozen bad things that technology has been used for. And that's really something that we have to take into consideration about the boundaries of what it means to be human. And he talks about, goes on and says, there's nothing remembered. And we just had President's Day. And somebody said, well, you know, we remember things. We have holidays that makes us remember things. But do we commemorate things? We don't really remember them. Because none of us here, except for maybe Roby, remember George Washington. No one really remembers George Washington, and no one really remembers the Civil War. So as far as actually knowing somebody, I mean, many of us probably know the names of our parents and grandparents. We know the names of our parents, but grandparents and great-grandparents. But how long does it take before we may know their name and we may see their photographs, but we have no real knowledge of who they were as people? It's like, when you really think about it, our ability to know things, to remember events and people, pretty limited. Pretty limited. So the best that we can hope for is our children will know who we are, and our grandchildren, if we live long enough, might know who we are. But our great-grandchildren probably won't know who we are. They won't remember us in that way. Talking about all of the limitations of human beings, there's a book called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. He was a survivor of the Holocaust. And he, through his sufferings, if you ever want to... if you're ever interested in reading about and many of you in here probably were small children at the end of World War II, and so you may remember what it was like when the stories first came out about the atrocities of World War II. If you ever want to depress yourself and take a dim view of humanity, read up on some of what went on in World War II in the Nazi death camps, because it is grim reading, let me tell you. Grim reading that what one group of human beings could turn around and do to another group of human beings. But in his observations during his time in the prison camps, what separated the people who survived from the people who didn't is people who could somehow find a way to ascribe meaning to their lives. Whether it was they had a family, they thought they had a family alive somewhere, and so I have to stay alive so I could be reunited with my family. Or it was a connection with God. Or sometimes it was even antagonistic. I'm going to stay alive to thwart the plans of the Nazis to kill all the Jews. Whatever it was, however form that they took, the people who survived were the people who could find a way to find meaning in their lives, no matter how brutal they were. And that's the way we are as people. We have to have some meaning. So when you evacuate the meaning out of life, then people become despondent. That's why rich people commit suicide. Because no matter all they have, they cannot find any meaning in their life. And so that's why that happiness and being able to find meaning is not really dependent upon our situation many times. It's dependent upon our ability to find some way to have meaning, whether it's family, or whether it's our work. However people do it, they have to find some way. And when that meaning is evacuated, no matter how much they have, no matter how good they may have it, the way other people see it, they say, what possible reason would they have to commit suicide? Well, it's because they've looked at life and they can't find any meaning. And that's what life is under the sun. For those who can find some meaning, it's barely temporary outside of Christ. So what are we left with? We looked at this endless cycle, this nothing new, this kind of drab weariness that if you look at the world a certain way, and we've all probably experienced that at times, looking at it and we think, why bother to get up today? And it's just the same thing over and over again. It's just the beat goes on, the drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain, la-di-da-di-day, la-di-da-di-da. It just goes on and on and on. But fortunately, there is a voice from someone beyond the sun. Turn to John chapter 8. John chapter 8, verse 23. This is Jesus speaking. He said to them, "You are from below. I am from above. You are of this world. I am not of this world." So we have Jesus. He's news from the outside. He's news from beyond the sun. Jesus comes in. He says, "I don't think the way you do because I'm not from around here. I come from somewhere different. I come from someplace else." And so Jesus joins us, comes to be with us in our frenzied, fruitless activity, but not to participate in it, not to come in and just join the rat race, not to come in and be another lemming that runs off the cliff of nothingness, but to pierce through from beyond the sun with the meaning that we're all searching for. Everybody's searching for meaning. He pierces through and says, "Here's a permanent meaning for you, a way that you can make sense of all this activity you find yourself in." And so in our remaining time, we're going to look at two ways that Jesus overcomes the futility of life under the sun. One, how he breaks the repetitious cycle. And two, how he brings us something that's really new. Because that's the two things that the preacher pointed to. He said we're trapped in an endless cycle and there's nothing new. Whether Jesus breaks the cycle, one way that he breaks the repetitious cycle for us, and one way that he brings us something truly new. In Hebrews chapter 10, the writer tells us that Jesus breaks the repetitious cycle that was necessary for the sacrifice for sins. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 through 4. "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sin? But in these sacrifices there is a reminder of sin every year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins." So this one of the repetitious cycles that the people were locked into, that the Jewish nation was locked into, is this constantly having to offer the sacrifice, reminding people over and over again, "You're sinners, we have to kill animals because of your sin." Over and over again, constantly reminded, there's no way out of this cycle because these repetitious sacrifices can never take away sin. So look down in verses 11 through 14. "And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified." So this endless cycle over and over again, the constant streams of blood that flow from the altar to cover the sins of the nations, to cover our sins. One time, he was able to break that repetition by offering himself a sacrifice that could for all time perfect those who are being sanctified, to break through that cycle, that meaningless, futile, not gaining anything cycle, and say once and for all, we can break that permanently and perfect those who are being sanctified. That's me and you. And that endless cycle is no longer there anymore. There was one sacrifice for sins. So that's one way that he gets us out of that, gives us meaning, is he says, no longer is there a cycle of sin, sacrifice. There's been one sacrifice that can take care of the job for all times. There's no need to repeat it over and over again and get nowhere. So he breaks the repetitious sacrifice for sins. And then he brings us something truly new, the new birth. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 to 5. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time." He brings a new birth. And what makes this different? See, the preacher was saying there's nothing new. Whatever happened before has happened again. But this is not a birth like any other birth. This is a spiritual birth that gives us life that's completely different from anything that we can know under the sun. It's breaking through into us here and saying, hey, this is spiritual life such as never been known on the earth before. And not some patched up version of an old idea. Not just some new technology that shuffles things around but doesn't really get rid of the limitations of humanity. It says, no, this new birth helps you transcend, makes you a new humanity, brings you into a life with God that is going to be kept for you in heaven. And so one day you'll be able to transcend this or break free of the cycle, break free of the old dead ways and participate in that new ways, a new life that this world cannot experience, could never experience in and of itself under the sun. It can only be experienced from the outside, piercing through and coming in. That new birth that we hopefully everyone in this room has taken part of. That born anew, born into of the Spirit of God. Something that could never be achieved on our own merits. But the limitations of our humanity is broken through by what God has done for us in His Son. By breaking the repetition of the cycle of sin once for all. And then when we participate in that in faith, then that gives us a new life. Something that's truly new. A new birth, a new life, a new way, new kingdom to live in that is above and beyond this world.